Today, the intergenerational property meat grinder with Leith Van Onselen. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, Wealth Notice Post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Leith Van Onselen. Hi there.
G'day, Martin. Thanks for having me on. Great to be on here. And great to have a chat with you today.
Well, it's great to have you on, you know, esteemed macro business contributor, economist, you know, champion data person. For those who don't know you, just give people a little bit of intro as to your background and how come we're chatting.
Yeah, well, basically, I'm an economist that used to work at the Australian Treasury. I did the graduate program there, worked there for several years. Finally left Canberra, went to the Victorian government, worked there in the Treasury. Before moving to Goldman Sachs for 5 years, where I didn't actually work as an economist, but I worked on the regulatory capital side of the business. And the last 10 years, I can't believe it's been that long, I've actually gone independent with my partner in crime, David Llewellyn Smith. And we set up an independent, economics slash market site called Macro Business. And I've been doing that for 10 years working from home. So I'm very well set up for the pandemic, I'll tell you that much.
Well, funnily enough, so am I, because I have the home studio here at home. And, you know, in fact, I set up DFA roughly similar time ago. So it's quite, we've been sort of parallel tracking. And in fact, you know, we sort of do actually feature each other sometimes. And of course, we've also got the other link with Nucleus Wealth as well.
That's right. Yeah, I'm actually the I'm the chief economist at Nucleus Wealth as well, with Damien Klassen and of course, my partner in crime, Macro Business, David Llewellyn Smith, and all the other good folk there. It's certainly been a busy few years, but again, glad to be at home for this this horrible 18 months we've had, especially living in Melbourne.
Absolutely,
world lockdown record.
Absolutely, we're locked down about hopefully to end. But look, this conversation today is a really, really important one. And both you and I have a very strong view about the intergenerational challenges that have been created, frankly, due to, 30 plus years of bad policy?
Absolutely, yeah. It's terrible. It's obviously, you know, we've got this situation where I think Australia's becoming a bit of a class system. Wasn't like that in the past. If you don't mind, I'll just throw a quick anecdote out there. My parents both migrated here in the 1950s and 60s, and they basically came with nothing. Both their families were very poor, you know, post-war migrants. And at the time when they bought their first house in the early 1970s, they were both working, you know, menial jobs. Both had never been to university, yet they were able to buy a detached house in a good suburb, pay it off within about 10 years because we had super high inflation back then and high nominal wage growth. And now that house that my mum still lives in is worth many, many millions of dollars. And, you know, needless to say that if someone starting out in exactly the same position as they did back in the 1970s wouldn't have a hope. And especially without parental parental support. So it's definitely an issue that I feel very strongly about, partly because I've got two young kids. I've got a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old. So I sort of worry about their future.
Yes, and I see it in my surveys too. You know, there is definitely a big divide between those families that have property and can actually quite often pass some of that value down to the next generation and those who are trying to get in for the first time. And, you know, the picture I have is that the train is leaving the station and, you know, people are on the platform trying to jump on the train as it's taking away. And it really is almost impossible now for people without wealth in the family to get on the bandwagon.
Yeah, that's right. As I said, it's becoming a bit of a class system, which it's kind of the opposite of what Australia used to be. Australia used to be known as quite egalitarian and sort of a fair-go nation. I think now it's just, especially the last 20-odd years, it's really changed. And, you know, I'm 43 years old. I'm lucky enough to have obviously gotten on the wagon, 15 years ago. So I'm okay, but it's that next generation. And I often think that if I was even 10 years younger than I am, my financial situation would be a lot different than it is now, purely because of the price of property, nothing else.
And the point to make here is this is actually a deliberate, intentional set of policies that have happened over a period, right? It isn't just happenstance. It isn't just, nobody's to blame. There are people that you can actually say they had a hand in making this thing happen the way it's happened.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been 20 years of deliberate demand pumping through, you know, various means, and obviously, you know, it's got us to the situation we're in, and unfortunately, there's absolutely no appetite to turn it around.
Well, let's have a look at some data, because of course I'd expect you to have data, being an economist and being on macro business, and you know, on DFA we love data. So there's a very interesting slide we might start with, which is essentially talking about the growth and how it's really differentially changed the benefits of old versus the young.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a chart here from the left-hand side. I pulled it from the Reserve Bank of Australia's submission to the latest housing affordability inquiry, about the 10th one, I think. Obviously, nothing will come out of it.
It's all supply side.
That's it. Yeah, it's all about supply. Don't mention demand. But the So that chart effectively just charts the house price to income ratio across all the various markets. Now, I could have put one on my own in there, but I've only got one at the national level, so I thought I'd just put this in there. And effectively, what it shows, it's not really reflected perfectly, this chart, but in about 1990, the typical house price in Australia was about 2.5 times household incomes. And now, nationally, it's about 6 times. And obviously, it's a lot worse in the major states of, you know, Victoria, New South Wales, Sydney and Melbourne. And what this has meant is that those who are already in the market, you know, especially, I guess, the older generations, the baby boom generations, the pre-boomers, et cetera, who got their houses cheap, have obviously experienced an absolutely massive rise in wealth. Now there's a table on the right-hand side, which the New Daily summarised from the latest HILDA survey, which is the Household Income Labor Dynamics Survey, which gets published every year. And what it effectively shows is the huge rise in wealth between 2002 and 2018 amongst the older population. So those aged, 65 plus mainly, have nearly doubled their wealth over that time, whereas those in the younger cohorts have experienced much less growth. And what that effectively tells you is that the price of housing has gone up, so it makes it harder. So not only the young who haven't been in the market haven't enjoyed the wealth increase, but also makes it obviously harder for them to get in. Now, this data only goes to 2018, and we know that the last 12 months in Australia, we've seen absolutely phenomenal house price growth.
Yes.
Sydney's gone about 25% this year alone, Brisbane about 20%, Melbourne about 17%. Pretty much all the markets are looking at 15 to 25% plus growth this year, which all that means is that table on the right, I can't wait till the next data comes out, because it's going to be absolutely painful to see.
And I will make the point that my surveys, because I'm tracking, you know, almost real time what's going on, really amplifies the trend, right? I mean, the HILDA data is 3 years old, and I get a bit frustrated when the RBA quotes data back then to try and justify position now, right? The fact is that things have got extremely, you know, more distorted because of the poor policies over a long period of time. So what that basically means is that the RBA is able to trot out data that doesn't look too bad, when in fact the reality now for many people is it's much, much more extreme. And I get quite cross about that.
Oh, absolutely. And as we've seen this last 12 months, the biggest house price boom pretty much in my lifetime, maybe the one in the late 80s when I was a, you know, young kid might have been slightly worse, but it's effectively the most broad-based house price boom I've seen in my living memory. And, you know, we've seen it coast to coast, pretty much every single market, regional, capital city, every state, every territory has seen absolutely explosive growth in the last 12 months. And so all that means is that obviously the barrier to entry is getting harder. And obviously those who are in the market are making out like bandits, whereas those who aren't, or future Australians, are going to be worse off. So it's a direct intergenerational wealth transfer going on.
Right. And of course, the two prime levers are interest rates being cut to billio, right? I mean, they were being dropped before we had COVID, and then the RBA cut them even more. And then lending standards, which mean that effectively people have higher multiples of debt relative to income. And okay, from a serviceability perspective, with interest rates so low, it's just about manageable for some. But if rates go the other way, then that's another question. So the point is, it's actually demand-driven, credit-driven It's not actually anything to do with the, you know, lack of property and those sorts of things, which of course is what all of the policymakers in Canberra like to claim. It's all supply side stuff, you know, build more houses and everything will be fine. No, this is actually a demand driven, credit driven bubble, which by the way is being replicated in many other countries around the world as well at the moment, which is directly correlated with ultra low interest rates.
Yeah, and we also know why the government likes to bang on about supply, basically because that's what the developer lobby wants. So, you know, it's easy to throw the supply side under the bus because the Housing Industry Association, the Property Council, the Master Builders, they all want to be able to build homes more easily at a lower cost and obviously have their taxes reduced because it's good for their business. So it's effectively a government industry policy rather than a housing affordability policy. I'm certainly not saying that building more houses is necessarily bad, but it's a bit rich to point that as the finger when you got this massive demand pump in. And then at the same time, obviously wanted to throw open the immigration floodgates again, which of course means you need more supply. So it's, I guess I'm very cynical about the government's motives here.
It's cynical central, I think, because both you and I share quite common views. The other point, of course, is that the supply side of things is all state policy, right? It's about land release. It's about, you know, all of the take at the state level. So in a way, the federal government's like, nothing to do with us. You know, they can just blame other people. And of course, both the Reserve Bank and APRA say house prices, nothing to do with us, which I find the biggest load of baloney that I can find anywhere.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, let's go on to the next data point, because there are some consequences of this skew of wealth towards older households. And essentially what that means is that, ownership rates have really moved quite the wrong way, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So unfortunately, the data is a little bit old here too, because, we only get proper home ownership rate data during the census. Mm. And obviously, we've just done the 2021 census. So... which we're not going to get the results for until next year. So take this data with a grain of salt. But what I've basically done here is plotted the census home ownership data by key age demographics since 1961, between 1961 and 2016. And what it shows is that the two oldest demographics, the 55s to 64s and the 65s plus, have had absolutely zero reduction in home ownership rate. In fact, the 65 plus have gone up. Their home ownership rates are actually slightly above what they were in 1961. Whereas the key young demographics, 25s to 34s and 35s to 41s, have actually had quite a meaningful reduction, of 10% or more reduction in home ownership rates over that time. So what I probably should have done if I could have found the data is it's not just home ownership rates, it's also people carrying debt. So Or the proportion of homes that are owned outright has also fallen through the floor as people are carrying mortgages for longer as well. So, again, this just shows this sort of intergenerational divide whereby those who got in early and got homes cheap have had zero negative impact and they've seen their wealth rise, whereas, the younger generations have basically been increasingly locked out.
Mm. And I'll make another point there, and that is in my surveys, what I'm seeing is that more people now are going into retirement still with mortgages. So they're actually holding debt later in life. First-time buyers, the average age of first-time buyers in my surveys is rising significantly. So now it's about 5 or 6 years later on average before people can actually go and buy a property. So there are more people who never get in because it's just too difficult, right? So this whole skew of debt, and what that actually means is that the proportion of people in the population who actually own their property outright with no mortgage is actually sliding.
Absolutely.
So we see a rise in those who remain in rented accommodation for a lot longer and perhaps always, and a proportion who hold a mortgage has gone up a little. But the proportion that actually own their property outright has gone through the floor. Now, the other point about this point about as people move into older age, they've still got to service those mortgages now into retirement. And that's putting a huge pressure on their finances later in life too, because it used to be that what you do is you'd buy a property, you'd live through your working life, but you'd actually accumulate sufficient to be able to actually perhaps downsize without a mortgage before retirement. But that's all gone too.
Yeah, and but not only that, obviously, in the old days, you'd have your mortgage paid off by the time you retire, so there'd be less outgoing. So you wouldn't have to pay rent. You also wouldn't be paying a mortgage, so you can live on a lot less money. But to your point, that also raises a pretty big issue for the retirement system because we're likely to see people basically take their superannuation as a lump sum and just use it simply to pay off the mortgage and then not have money and just fall back on the age pension. So there's issues there. And then for those who never got into the housing market, we all know that renters fare a lot worse in retirement than homeowners. So, so they're going to be stuck paying rents into their old age. So it's kind of a double whammy for the retirement system there.
Well, I'll add just one more whammy to you know, make three. And that is, of course, many people are assuming that they'll be able to sell their property and liquidate, you know, the value at some point towards retirement and perhaps move into somewhere smaller. That, of course, is predicated on the assumption that prices will go on rising, right? And the question is, you know, if you think about the rates coming way down and the very loose lending standards, we're almost at the end of that runway. So, you know, is it reasonable to expect the trajectory of home price growth to continue at similar rates that we've seen? Maybe, but maybe people could also be hostage of fortune too, because if prices don't continue to rise, then that get out of jail card that they hold may not be quite as powerful as they think.
Yeah, I actually used to think that, and this, I guess, a year ago, I thought we were sort of at the bottom of mortgage rates, but observing what's happened in, you know, other places like I think Denmark and Japan and some other places around Europe, the next phase in this, and this is just because we've got idiot policymakers, I think will be they'll end up just going negative interest rates. So they'll end up paying the banks to lend. So for every dollar a bank lends, they might get, I don't know, 5 cents or something, or, you know. So basically what that'll mean is, you know, we'll still be paying positive mortgage rates, but instead of being 2% as the bottom floor, it'll come down to 1.5% and then maybe 1%. You know, that's how cynical I am these days, and we've seen it overseas. So I think they could, every time we get into trouble, we're probably going to see the RBA pull out this kind of move just to pump prime the market again.
Well, they've got no other policy, have they? So they have to take rates lower. And, you know, the Eurozone has that at the moment. So, in fact, if you look at some of the Eurozone countries, every time the bank makes a loan, they get basically a credit from from the ECB, right? And, of course, even our term funding facility, which was the very cheap money that the RBA threw at the banks, if you follow the money there, you know, CBA got, what, $35 billion of the term funding facility? That turned into 4 basis points of value for their last results in terms of you know, the end result, and that allowed them to basically buy back shares. So we are already directly supporting the banks through the Reserve Bank, through those cheap rates. So there's no reason why they can't go on doing that.
Yes, too big to fail, Martin.
Okay, so let's go on to the next part of the discussion then. If you think about home buyer deposits, this is the other killer argument, isn't it?
Yeah, so, although mortgage rates have fallen, so mortgage rates are obviously at their lowest level in history, or, you know, 1 month off the lowest rate, now that fixed are starting to tick up a little bit. But despite that, the biggest barrier to getting the housing market has obviously been able to come up with a deposit. So according to the Reserve Bank, so this is all data from the RBA's submission to the Housing Affordability Inquiry. It was quite good. Shows that the average first home buyer deposit has increased to about 80% of one of an annual earnings, and the time taken to actually save a deposit has rocketed to about 9 years in Sydney and 7 years in Melbourne if you're a first home buyer. So that there is probably the bigger barrier now to getting a mortgage. It's can you save up a big enough housing deposit? And what we've seen is, as you know from your surveys, and you document every month, more and more first home buyers now are relying on the old bank of mum and dad to see their way in the housing market, because they simply takes them too long to save, and when you have prices going up so quickly, you know, you can save like a madman, and then you're just watching the price continually ratchet up, and it's like becomes this this race that you can never win. So that's why we're seeing now, obviously, you know, people turn to their parents for parental support, which then again turns us into this class society I was telling you about, where if you've got wealthy parents or you've got wealthy enough parents and they can help you, you're okay. But if you don't, you're basically shut out.
And the $95,000 on average is the amount that's handed across, right, from parents to their kids to help them buy that property. It does vary dramatically, right? So, you know, in Sydney, it's a lot more, in other places, a bit less. But I've seen that continually rise in recent times. And also the proportion of first-time buyers who now have to lean on the bank of mum and dad is remarkably high. The bank of mum and dad is within the top 10 lenders in Australia.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. And, you know, pretty much just about everyone I know who's bought a house recently is, I mean, younger people, not my generation, the one below, but you know, they've all had some kind of assistance. And, you know, obviously their parents worry about them. And it's one of those things. It's one of those things whereas if you do it for one person, so you do it for your own child, it's rational and it doesn't impact prices. But if everyone does it,
yep,
you just end up obviously inflating prices. It's a bit like first home buyer grants, and it ends up making the affordability situation worse for everyone else.
Well, I'll make one other point. A lot of people, the bank of mum and dad is actually equity drawdown from the equity out of their existing property, right? So quite often you see their mortgage going up. So we've actually got, think of the debt flows there. We've actually got more debt coming in at the top end of the market where there's a lot of equity, right? That flows down through. And then the first-time buyer gets in with a higher price and can basically bid the price up because they've got the support. So this debt multiplier effect is quite interesting, right? And so, again, you can just see how strongly this whole thing is being powered by ever greater household debt.
Yeah, it's a worry. And it is basically this sort of positive feedback loop we're going. And unfortunately, the Australian economy, and it's not just us, it's, you know, New Zealand as well, it's probably even worse. You know, it's all geared around housing. So it's like, although in mining going as the industry statistics has been the biggest industry in Australia, effectively it is, because it's number one driver of consumer spending and all this, and the wealth effect, and it's got its tentacles in all areas of the economy, which is why the federal government and policymakers, state governments, etc., they're all in on the on keeping the game alive.
Absolutely.
Which is why I think, you know, I don't think we're seeing the bottom of rates. I think they could go further because they've got no choice, and they'll just end up, you know, doing what Japan's done, what the ECB's done, which is quite depressing.
So there was a very interesting article actually in New Zealand saying New Zealand economy is effectively a housing market with a small economy bolted on the side, right?
That was from Bernard Hickey, I think. He used to be at interest.co. He's a good guy. I've actually had coffee with Bernard a few times when he's been there. He's got his brother lives in Melbourne, so
very good definition. I think you probably say maybe we've also got a resource sector as well, but actually the housing sector. And if you look at the total value of property relative even to the stock market, right, property is way higher.
Yeah, well, in Australia, it's I probably should have thrown this chart in here, but in Australia, it's about four times GDP. Our property market. New Zealand's about 4.5. So as expensive as you think it is here, New Zealand's even worse. Their property market is like something I've never seen before. Auckland is their Sydney. And, you know, while Sydney's experienced about 25% growth over the last year, Auckland went up about 35%. So it's another world over there.
Right. And of course, Adrian Orr has lifted interest rates already, and there's talk now about more interest rates rises ahead to try and actually tame this housing. And of course, they have actually given the Reserve Bank over there a direct responsibility to think about monetary policy in the context of housing and vice versa, right?
Whereas that's because the Reserve Bank of New Zealand's actually got dual function. So a bit like the Bank of England used to be. So basically, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is APRA and the RBA in one, whereas here we're obviously split up. So I actually think that creates better policy because it means that interest rates are going to pull in the same direction as macroprudential policy. Yep. Whereas here we always have. Sometimes I wonder if the RBA and APRA even talk.
They've got the Council of Financial Regulators, isn't that? I call that Philip Lowe's other brain.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, yeah. Look, I'm a pretty cynical guy these days, but I just don't think they tend to communicate well. And I think a bit like the federal system we've got here, where we've got effectively the federal government, the state government, and then local councils. That sort of structure leads to a lot of buck passing. So effectively, the RBA can buck pass to APRA and vice versa. The federal government buck passes to the states. The states buck pass to the federal government and policy here. Whereas what if we were to make RBA like the RBNZ and have dual responsibility and merge APRA and the RBA, they couldn't buck pass anymore, and they're probably more likely to coordinate. So I think that'd be a good system.
Well, it's interesting because Lowe says, look, I'm not going to spend too much time worrying about house prices because that's not something that I directly influence, right? Which for me is a really crazy position to take, but it's quite convenient.
And then you just point the gun at APRA. It's APRA's problem. So, again, it'd be good if we could import the RBNZ over here. They at least I've got to say New Zealand. New Zealand is a crazy got a crazy housing market, but they at least try, or they at least pretend to try. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand has been very early on macroprudential. You've got the Ardern government over there, is at least has done something about negative gearing. They're doing all sorts of policies. Whether you agree with them or not, they're at least trying, and they've acknowledged the problem. In Australia, we don't acknowledge the problem. So we just try and fob it off as some, supply side, scapegoat.
Well, let's go on to talk then about this other big argument, because a lot of people are say, look, you're making too much fuss about house prices because it's easy to service a mortgage at the moment because rates are so cheap. So therefore, serviceability ain't a problem. And therefore, that really is really the story. So don't worry about repaying, just service.
Yeah, look, the reason why I've got a bit of a problem with that argument, there is some truth in it, obviously. Obviously, mortgage rates have fallen. The percentage of current household income required to repay a mortgage has obviously come down with that. So if you already had a mortgage, life's easier than it was, say, 2 years ago. If you're already in the market, that's 100% true. The aggregates show that. The issue I've got with that is that prior generations, and again, I'll point to my parents. I'm not throwing shade at them. This is just what happened. They bought the house in 1972 in Melbourne, paid about 3.5 times income, to live in a pretty good area, and because inflation was very high back then, and also wage growth was at least nominally, so compared to inflation was very high. So you had high inflation, high wage growth because of high inflation. What that meant was that their debt started off as this, which was already a small amount, and within a decade it had gone to this because their incomes and the price of everything else had gone up so quickly that that their mortgage was effectively inflated away. The problem for current generations is you take on a massive mortgage from day one, like a jumbo mortgage, huge, but then you've got this incredibly record low wage growth. There's a chart I put up there a second ago, which had effectively the last decade, we had zero real growth in household disposable income. I use HILDA here, but I could have used the ABS. So what that means is, because we've got such low inflation and effectively such low nominal wage growth and almost zero real wage growth, what it means is that it's going to take you forever to pay off these mortgages because the debt is not going to get inflated away through rising inflation and rising incomes. So a jumbo mortgage today is still going to be a very, very big mortgage in, say, 15 or 20 years' time, other things equal, because the principal's so big. So the mortgage rates are low, the interest payments are going to be low, but the principal's massive, and that still has to be repaid. My issue with that whole argument is, yeah, okay, if you're already in the market, rates have fallen, that's great. But if you only bought recently, you've also got a ginormous mortgage to service that could take you 40, 50 years because your wages just aren't going up. So that's the big difference between the barriers that the current generation faces with property versus someone who bought 20 years ago plus, back in the era of higher interest rates and also when property prices were much lower.
And there's a
I hope
couple
that
of,
made sense.
yeah, a couple of observations there. The first is, of course, the concept of paying off your mortgage, right, is actually quite alien to quite a few people now. So in my surveys, I see a lot of people who just assume that they will always have that mortgage until ultimately they sell the property when they retire or later, right? They don't assume they're going to pay it off, right? Second point is, if you look at the average duration of a new mortgage, it used to be 20, 25 years. a lot of people are now going 35 years, right? We're starting to get almost to the intergenerational mortgage too. And of course, in Japan.
Yeah. Like Japan, 50 years or going to 100, I think.
Now, that's great for the banks because what that means is that you basically are a cash flow and you'll always be a cash flow and you just keep keeping the cash flow going or you keep servicing the loan. That's great for them. But my question is, what does that do then to, you know, individuals, households, wealth and those sorts of things? But also, what does it do to society overall? Because if effectively we've got more of our money just flowing to bigger mortgages just to keep the mortgages going, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So effectively the banks have kind of put you on a subscription model. Just think about it. So, you know, every month we pay our Netflix, we pay our phone bill, we pay our whatever. Effectively, the banks have put us on a perpetual subscription model for a house.
Yep.
And what that means is when you've got to pay this subscription every month, you know, i.e. mortgage, which is never going to end for a lot of people, or, you know, they're carried into their old age, it effectively means you've got no money to spend elsewhere. So, you know, it's a great model for the banks. Like, there's a reason why, you know, the big tech companies want to get everyone on subscriptions because it's a great earner, it's stable, etc. But effectively, the banks are putting us all on subscription models. You know, obviously, if you're spending $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 a month on your mortgage, that's money you don't have to spend on everything else. So it's going to obviously, you know, smash the economy elsewhere, but it's great for the banks.
Absolutely. Well, I say to people, do you realize you are basically a net present value of your future cash flows? That's what you're worth, right? And that explains why banks go after particular types of customers rather than not, why they like bigger mortgages rather than smaller, and why they, you know, particularly like some. So in a way, their model of risk assessment is now very different from what it used to be, because it's not actually about paying the loan back.
Yeah, it's a subscription service, effectively. You know, it's a great cash cow for them.
Yeah.
You know, it's steady cash flow. It's cash flow that lasts decades. You know, from their point of view, what's not to like?
Mm. And you made the point earlier on, too big to fail. The fact is now that they are so entrenched in the way that our economy works that they will always be supported by government policy. And so international investors look at our large banks as basically government backed.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it also shows out in their funding. Like the major banks get a credit ratings. I think it was two notches in their credit rating because they're perceived as having an implicit government guarantee.
Yep.
You know, in some ways, I just think the government should just make it explicit and charge them a bootload of insurance for it. You might remember that bank tax a few years ago. They tried to sort of, you know, do it, but it was token amount.
It was totally token, yeah.
Yeah, you might as well just do it properly. I mean, let's just pull the curtain back and admit what we are. And just price it directly, properly. But of course, it won't happen. It's a lot easier to be, you know, behind a curtain and out of sight.
Right. And just on that, the other point, of course, is the power of the banks and their ability to influence and lobby the politicians, particularly at the federal level, is you know, well known. And some of the ways that policies come out are in reaction to the lobbying from those large organisations who can protect their position very powerfully. So there's another set of wheels within wheels going on here.
Yep, totally.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. And, you know, sometimes people don't think about this stuff as perhaps you as I do, but once you start doing it, you realize just how all the cards in the deck are stacked the same way, right? So
yeah, thanks, unfortunately, one of the most demoralizing things I've done in this last 10 years being with Macro Business is obviously pumping out 10 to a dozen articles a day on all sorts of issues. You really cannot take a step back from the news, and you've got to, in all sorts of areas, I've sort of worked out how the sausage is made.
Mm.
And I've got to watch this stuff, and it's pretty vile. And you know, it's enough to turn you incredibly cynical. And sometimes I get quite depressed about it, but, I've actually become less depressed over time, the housing thing, because I've accepted it. I'm just kind of, that's the way it is. So I don't get so angry about it anymore, but you still got to recognize it.
Yes, absolutely. And the other point there is that when people make decisions about their own personal circumstances, they should, you know, make them in the context of some of these broader macro themes, right? So that effectively you don't get caught, because if you just make an assumption about the way the world works one way and it works a different way, you can sometimes get rather out of position.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, there's another interesting slide. I'll just put it up. And this is the fact that the structure of where people live is also changing dramatically because of this affordability problem.
Yeah. Now, anyone who watches, who reads Macro Business is going to know that one thing I hate more than anything is just this government policy of just piling as many people into our cities as possible just to create economic growth through running a massive immigration program. Now, the intergenerational report was released a couple of months back, and what that basically says is it's effectively Australia's population policy. It's not called that, but that's effectively what it is. And it's run by the Australian Treasury, which obviously loves collecting more tax revenue because the federal government collects the taxes, the state governments, and everyone else has to pay the costs. And they love, you know, big population growth because more people means more taxes. And the intergenerational report effectively, explicitly projected that we're going to add 13.1 million people. That's a 50% population increase over the next 40 years on the back of, huge amounts of immigration. And what this is, 13.1 million, just to put this into perspective, that's the equivalent of taking today's population in Australia and adding a Brisbane, a Sydney, and a Melbourne in just 40 years. Now, if you live in Melbourne, it took you 170 years to get to 3.2 million people at the turn of the century. Melbourne has already added 50% in the last 20 years on the back of high immigration. And under this sort of policy, the ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, predicts that Melbourne's population is going to double by about 2060. It's not quite as extreme, but it's almost as extreme for Sydney. Sydney took 212 years to get to 3.6 million people. And you've added about 1.5 million people in just 20 years since the turn of the century. And again, you're going to have, Sydney's supposed to get to about 9.5 million by about 2066. So the upshot of all this is that future generations are increasingly going to be forced to live in apartments, whereas houses, detached houses, were obviously the norm for my parents. For my generation in Melbourne, it's still the norm. It's becoming less common. But what I put up there was the chart from the Urban Task Force, and that was their projection of what Sydney's housing stock would look like in 2056. 2056, I believe. Sorry, 2057. So effectively, in 2016, so 4 or 5 years ago, 55% of Sydney's dwellings were detached houses, and you had about 30% apartments. By 2057, only 25% of Sydney's dwellings are going to be detached houses, and 50% are going to be apartments, and the rest are townhouses. So what that means is that effectively, only those who got in early, or those who are obviously extremely wealthy, will be able to afford to live in a house in Sydney by that time, whereas everyone else is going to be effectively forced to live, most of them, in apartments, or a smaller number in townhouses. And to me, that there's something seriously wrong with that. So we talk about intergenerational housing. This is another form of it, where my children, my grandchildren, eventually, are going to basically be forced to live in apartments. And I've got a bit of an issue with that. Some people might think, oh, it's inevitable, blah blah blah. But the fact of the matter is, Australia has always been known to have this great quality of life, and that is basically going to be turned upside down purely by this fetish of just doubling the size of our the size of our cities in a fairly short amount of time. And I've got a bit of a problem with that, to be quite frank. I don't think that's the way to go, and I don't think it's going to raise living standards for future Australians.
Mm. Well, it's a matter of quality of life, isn't it? Partly, if you actually are in high rise. Frankly, the quality of construction of a lot of the high rise is very low. There's a lot of defects. About one in three. In Sydney, there was a recent report that said, close to 50% probably had some defects. Right. So
yeah.
And noise is one of the things that people just don't understand unless you actually live in the high rise environment. Right. Noise is a big issue. The cost of being part of a community the ongoing maintenance costs are actually quite a lot higher than some people think. But also the fact that it's very hard to get, you know, exercise and you know, all those things that you take for granted. The other point, of course, is with that quantum of population growth, the infrastructure, and I'm thinking everything from water and roads and power, you know, that's not been thought through either, has it? So basically, right. We're, you know, take you know, the amount of water storage that we have, you know, for the population that we're talking about. None of it's thought through. So we've got no joined up thinking, and yet we just got this massive surge of people coming in. And if you measure GDP per capita versus GDP, you get a completely different answer, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I could honestly do probably 5 podcasts with you on this very topic, because I spent so many years writing about it, researching it. But yeah, effectively, look, Australia's productivity growth in the 15 years leading up to COVID, when we ramped up immigration, was, you know, it's almost the inverse of the population growth. Population growth went up, productivity growth went down. Similar with GDP per capita, similar with you know, household disposable income per capita. All those things. While the Australian economy looked good on an aggregate level, on a total level, because if you add in, you know, 1.5 to over 2% of people every year, your growth's going to look good on a whole. The pie is going to grow. But everyone's slice of that pie effectively got worse. And once you add in all the other costs that aren't captured by these, you know, financial type or economic accounting measures like congestion and, you know, air pollution, whether or not you can get a seat on a train, whether or not you live by a park, you know, living in a high-rise apartment versus living in a detached house, the water supply. It was only 2 years ago that Sydney was running incredibly low of water. You know, how's Sydney going to cope, you know, with another 3-4 million people, 5 million people? Like, none of these things are thought out. And we know they're not thought out because we all watched it in real time over the last 15 years. We saw the quality of life go down. You know, we saw infrastructure not keep up. We saw people suddenly being forced to live in apartments. And it's the definition of insanity to think you can do that all over again for the next 40 years and you're not going to get the same result. Of course you are. So, you know, that there's just another whole aspect of this intergenerational housing issue. It's the fact that future people are going to be forced to live in high-rise, defective, ugly apartments,
right,
in our capital cities.
And of course, the construction companies and, you know, those who actually have an invested interest in building higher and building lots are huge advocates of this strategy. But, you know, you only ever grand in China to think of how this could end up.
Yeah, that's right. And to your point, you were spot on. You said that the quality of construction is terrible. We've already saw the flammable cladding fiasco. We've seen, you know, the Opal Tower. We've seen Mascot in Sydney. There's a whole bunch of them that have had, you know, severe defects. And I feel sorry for the buyers who bought those properties because they're staring down financial ruin because no one's going to want to buy them. You know, so these people have sunk a lot of money into their apartments and they're just these financial money pits.
Yep.
You know, and they're stuck buying the body corpse. Still got the mortgage, still got the body corp. The body corp's going to have to, you know, spend millions on these rectifications. They've got to come up with that money. You know, it's just a diabolical situation. And people often say, oh, you know, their apartments are way more environmentally friendly. You don't put rooftop solar on an apartment. And, you know, like, I don't know. I'm not sure about you, but we hang our clothes out on the line. You know, it dries naturally. You can't do that in an apartment. You've got to put in a dryer. You know, there's all these negatives that aren't taken into account. And unfortunately, you know, it's just another one of these areas where younger Australians and future younger Australians are just going to have to cop it.
Absolutely. Well, 10 years ago, I moved out of Sydney. We're down near Wollongong on the coast, you know, in a relatively regional area. And every time I go up to Sydney, I just tear my hair out because I couldn't cope now with the traffic and the noise and the congestion and everything. And I'm thinking, well, when I first came to Australia, which was in 1995, I came from London, right? And the first thing I noticed was the space. And the fact that the traffic jams were nowhere near as bad as in London, whereas now it's gone worse. So we've lost something really important about the quality of life that Australia offered, I think.
Yeah, and I also think we've obviously just had the pandemic, right? Well, still having the pandemic. We've just had, Melbourne, we've had 260 odd days of lockdown. Sydney's 110 or something. I'm not sure. I don't really count it, but it's a lot. It's enough to lose what little hair I had left. And what we've seen through the pandemic is everyone's rushing to the regions. They're rushing out of the two major cities because people want space. Mm. They're, obviously being stuck in an apartment is especially a very small apartment during a lockdown, it's not a great place to be. You don't have open space. Like, I'm lucky to have a big backyard, I live in a low density area. I've got, I can look out and see trees. But surely this has taught us that, apartment living is not what it was sold as us to be. I mean, obviously it suits some people. I'm not saying if you live in an apartment, you shouldn't enjoy that. Some people can, but it shouldn't be forced upon us. It should be a choice. And unfortunately, and my fear is that it's no longer going to be a choice. You're going to be forced to do it unless you're very rich or you got in early.
And talk about rich and early. We should just touch on the tax and welfare system, because, of course, that's another pretty significant issue, isn't it, in terms of the way that things work?
Yeah. So, unfortunately, the tax and welfare system sort of favours this intergenerational housing problem we've got. I mean, obviously, look the flywheel is really the massive reduction in interest rates that we've had for 30-odd years, and which has obviously lifted all housing boats, and it meant that if you got in early, you've experienced massive wealth, and if you didn't, you've had to cop it. But on top of that, there's also there's also some other problems with the tax system, in that effectively the asset test for the age pension and welfare largely it effectively doesn't include the family home. So again, if you're someone who lives in a multi-million-dollar family home and you're asset rich and cash poor, you still, receive, very good benefits. Whereas if you're young, unemployed, you got to suffer on $43 a day of JobSeeker. Australia is also only one of seven countries not to have an inheritance tax. Now, obviously I can't see any of the listeners here, and you're probably throwing tomatoes at me. But, I'm not proposing that we put in a 50% tax or anything, but, I think a 5% tax on inheritances above a certain amount would be probably a sensible idea. We do have an aging population. The government keeps telling us we don't have enough tax revenue to support an aging population. Well, maybe we should tax the wealthiest generation in history to pay for the goods and services for the wealthiest generation in history. Just a thought. And research from the Grattan Institute has showed that, people, retirees over 65s today are paying less tax than they did 20 years ago. That's because of the Howard government's massive giveaways to pensioners and self-funded retirees, etc. Grattan also found that only one in six people aged over 65 pays any income tax. Now, might say, well, most of them aren't working. That's true. But we've also got these crazy policies, the senior and pensioners tax offset, which effectively means that, if you earn a certain amount in your retirement age, you pay way less tax than a younger person earning exactly the same amount in employment. So you got skews there. They'll get, obviously, bigger private health insurance rebates despite using the system more because they're old. You've got the superannuation system, which favours, obviously, which allows older Australians to basically earn, bucket loads of money on superannuation earnings tax-free. All these things are little distortions that give a free kick, I guess, to the older generations over the younger generations. And it just makes what it effectively means is that workers have to get taxed more to pay for the goods and services that we all use, and wealth is undertaxed. And I think we effectively need to transform the tax system away from wage income tax and more towards wealth and also consumption, I guess. But it's not just the housing story, it's also the tax and welfare story, which feeds into the housing story. It's a whole ecology behind it, which has created the situation that we're at.
So Saul Eslake made a very, very important point in his recent submission to the inquiry on housing supply and affordability. He said, just think about the relative numbers, right? From a political perspective, there are way more people with property, right, who are enjoying the benefits relative to those who are trying to get into the market. So from a political perspective, don't expect anything radical, because effectively it's status quo, it's where all the votes are. So I guess my question is that true, or is there a different set of arguments that we can muster as to why we've got to think about this differently to really try and solve some of these issues? Because if we don't, then of course it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah, it's a tough question. I think Sol Islay makes a pretty good point there. Unfortunately, most Australians are either, basically two-thirds, roughly, have either got a mortgage or they want to get it. Or they want to get in the housing market. They're in the housing market and they're paying off a mortgage. And once you do that, it's a bit like stamp duty. The whole stamp duty, the land tax debate, if you follow that one.
Yeah.
From an economic perspective, it's a no-brainer to get rid of stamp duty and replace it with a broad-based land tax. But while I write that all the time in macro business, and I always promote that policy, I'm living in the house I'm probably going to live in the next 30 years, right? Like, I got the biggest house I'm probably ever going to own. I paid a bucket load of stamp duty on it, like $80,000 or something like that when I bought it. And for me, that automatically has made me a vested interest against getting rid of stamp duty, because I've already paid it and I know that I can free ride off everyone else. Whereas if you put in a land tax, I'm suddenly paying again. And it's kind of a bit like that with this policy. Like, if you're in the market, you're paying off a mortgage and stuff. The last thing you want to see is the value, like, to go into negative equity or what is it, see the value of your asset fall.
Mm.
And unfortunately, what do they say? If there's a horse named special interest, always back it. Unfortunately, that plays out, and the politicians know this, and they play to our senses. And unfortunately, we saw it last election when Labor had their negative gearing policy, and they got rejected. So, it's a very hard thing to change. You effectively need everyone to act altruistic and to sort of care about the generations below them. But wanting people to act that way, which I pretty much spent 10 years hoping everyone would act that way, and I've sort of given up a bit, I guess. Knowing that, look, this is the way it is. It sucks, and it shouldn't be this way. But unfortunately, I can't see the situation changing anytime soon. And that's the reality of it. And it's quite depressing.
Mm. Well, it is what it is. But I guess step one is to call it out so people understand how the machine really works, rather than perhaps assuming it works differently. But you're right. There's this question of, what is society for? What's the economy for? I mean, there are some big philosophical questions here, because if you leave things with these sorts of settings, then basically, the economy sort of chunters on, but the stability of the economy actually degrades, because more and more of it is, collated around, property and debt and property and debt. And in the meantime, we don't invest in the things that we should for the future. And we've also got this massive problem where younger people can't get in and, can't play the same game. And I guess the question is, if you leave those settings wrong, does it eventually then lead to, almost civil unrest and, intergenerational disputes, because people just say, it was okay for you, but what about me?
Yeah, well, I mean, it certainly should. And to your point about the economy getting degraded, well, certainly that's happened in Australia. We've become more debt-dependent, more property-dependent. A tradable sector of the economy's been destroyed outside of mining. Unfortunately, the more the economy goes down that road, the more more dependent it becomes on this, on housing. So, because if you look at Australia's growth drivers, it's really just two things. It's bringing people in and selling houses and copies to them, and debt, and that's really it. And it all sort of that's kind of the ecosystem we've got now at the moment. So unfortunately, Australia's economy is becoming less and less sophisticated, which is a bad thing.
Mm.
And then that also makes it more risky. But unfortunately, the less sophisticated it becomes, the more you're going to get policies like this throwing resources at the housing market to keep it going. I always call it a Ponzi. Keep the Ponzi going.
Yeah, and the Ponzi is even more dramatic when you think about it. Nearly half of the dividends from the stock exchange come from the finance sector, right? And the finance sector predominantly is making most money from mortgage. So
yep.
That's a cycle. Of course, it also makes money from the construction cycle as well. But the other point there is that as this goes on and as the economy gets narrower and narrower and narrower, nothing else to support it. So basically the only thing in town then is to do more of the same thing, only more so. So that means that you get lower interest rates, you get more incentives for first-time buyers to try and drag them in. And, you know, you and I probably both agree that incentives don't help. They just lift the problem and just continue to perpetuate the problem. And it makes it more and more difficult for policymakers to even want to start trying to solve it. So ultimately, the only end game is that you go on doing more of the same until it gets to the point where it just falls in on itself.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think we'll get there a bit, but it could be decades. I mean, I could be 80 years old before, you know, before we get to that point. You just don't know. I mean, I made the mistake a year or so ago thinking that the lowest Australia's cash rate could go would be about 0.5% because we've got to fund the current account and blah, blah, blah. That was just a, you know, assumption. And then now we're down to, what, you know, 0.1 and that logically should be the bottom. But then we saw the term funding facility come in, which didn't obviously impact the variable mortgages, but it pushed down fixed mortgages. And then the next logical exposition is, like we said before, going the European route, the Japanese route, and starting the central bank starts paying banks to lend. So mortgages come down to 1.5%, 1%. Who knows where it's going to end? And I just think, unfortunately, you know, we're sort of on this treadmill, this rat wheel, and it just keeps spinning. They've got to pedal harder, but you know, you end up not going anywhere, and you're just shuffling wealth amongst the economy. Mm. You know, the 1%ers will get richer, and unfortunately, you're gonna have a larger proportion of people who miss out and become lifelong renters, or, you know, living in slum apartments.
Yeah. Last question. Interest rates, you know, are very, very low in Australia. New Zealand's put rates up slightly. There's talk about the Bank of England doing something. Is there a risk here to this whole edifice if rates do start rising?
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, there's obviously a lot of talk about inflation rising because of, you know, supply chain shortages, et cetera. But I don't think lifting interest rates would actually work to lifting interest rates works great on demand, but if you've got a supply side shock, it's not really, like, interest rates aren't going to fix that. And look, the Reserve Bank has been pretty adamant that, unlike previously, they're not going to move on monetary policy and interest rates until they actually see inflation. So it's not enough to expect inflation or predict inflation, because they've been hopeless at that. Mm. They're not going to move until they actually see it, which means they'll be reactive, not proactive. And they've said pretty clearly that they're not going to probably see decent inflation until we get decent wage growth. And my fear is that by rushing to, you know, reboot the pre-COVID immigration program or go even harder, we're less likely to see wage growth, which means we're less likely to see inflation. And maybe that's the whole point. That's why they love it, because keep interest rates lower for longer. You know, it provides more customers for the housing lobby to sell houses to, keeps more buyer demand, even if not mortgage demand, on property, and, you know, keeps the rental market tighter. And maybe that's the whole idea. Like, just bring people in to keep wages down, to keep interest rates a bit lower than they otherwise would be, and then obviously make the 1%ers, the owners of capital, I won't call out any people by name, but the owners of capital and the capitalists, the growth lobby, you know, happy, because for them it's a win-win-win.
Absolutely. Well, it is an interesting time, and I really appreciate your time today, and thank you very much for sharing your thoughts, Leif. And we'll put the macro business links and stuff below. Very, very important site. I visit it very often and occasionally make comments over there as well. You guys do a tremendous job, and I've really enjoyed speaking with you. Do come back and have another chat or two, because there are so many other things we could explore. And maybe you should come on one of the live shows and get questions from our audience too. That would be great too.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you want me on here on any topic, just let me know. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's great to finally do this with you, Martin. It's been a long time to make it.
Well, it's been worth the wait. Thank you very much. Have a great day, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks very much.
Cheers.